This is a Radio Charwell original podcast.
We love science!
So sport's quite important, isn't it?
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, I could just sit in front of the TV all day.
No, I'm so
And also, I've done a lot of things, so I'm kind of preparing patients before surgery and taking care of them after surgery.
Wow!
I'm doing observations.
Science
to
be
concerned.
Why don't you give me a
miss
back? What do you think?
Healthcare, mental health, vaccines, and
science and beyond.
As always, welcome back to Science and Beyond. As you may have guessed from today's title, this episode is all about sleep and its importance. And as a medical student, I think staying up late and having to do research on sleep is pretty ironic, but I'm getting by. Today we have two very special guest speakers. So first up, we have Lisa Artis, the Deputy CEO and Director of the Sleep Charity. And then we have Dr. Nicola Barclay, a senior postdoctoral researcher in sleep medicine at the University of Oxford. I hope that you enjoy this episode and that you all learn something new.
Hello. Hello. Hi. I'm Lisa Artis. I'm Deputy CEO of the Sleep Charity.
Nice to meet you, Lisa. So I would just like to ask, what do you do, like, your day-to-day job?
Oh gosh, I mean, I'm definitely someone who kind of is overseeing every aspect of the charity. Everything that we do, from kind of training and involved in research projects through to kind of creating information, advice sheets, sort of overseeing our National Sleep Helpline and getting involved with our kind of campaign and advocacy work as well. So no day is exactly the same in the charity. So it's a really great and varied role. Obviously, you know, having that sort of strategic oversight over everything we do, but also kind of just like, I'm really excited about what the future holds when it comes to sleep as well, and what us as a charity, you know, can how we can make a real impact and sort of transformational change going forwards.
That sounds like a really rewarding role. So let's go back to the very beginning. So kind of how did the Sleep Charity begin, and then how has it like progressed over the years into what it is today?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question as well. So the charity started around 13 years ago. We started out as the Children's Sleep Charity, and it was set up by our CEO and our founder, Vicky Beavers. And she set the charity up basically from her own lived experience. She had a child who didn't sleep for several years. That ultimately affected her sleep. And off the back of that, she became really unwell, and she really struggled to kind of get any kind of really good sleep support out there. And basically, she didn't want any other sort of parent and family to ever feel like that. So really wanted to, you know, put together a charity and like a sleep behavioural sort of programme that would help people going forwards. So, you know, she was really lucky to work closely with Professor Heather Elphick at Sheffield Children's Hospital, who evaluated our work with some really great outcomes. And really since then, the charity has flourished. We rebranded to the Sleep Charity in 2019, and that was really off the back of the fact that we weren't capturing the fact that we were changing parents' sleep when we were helping children and young people. So we kind of wanted to broaden our remit. I joined in 2020, so I headed up an organisation called the Sleep Council. I'd worked with Vicky for several years, and we decided it would be really good to actually join forces. We would bring sort of complementary skill sets together, and it would just give us really sort of strength in this voice we had in the sleep industry. And really since then, we've grown quite a lot. You know, we've evolved, we're sort of really active involved in lots of like steering groups, we're involved in research projects, obviously we're doing our own projects as well. And yeah, we you know, sort of the four sort of main cruxes of the work that we do is obviously around information and support. So it's providing that real clear, accessible advice. That's through our website. It's through things like our National Sleep Helpline. And we have some commissioned sleep services as well. It's through research, where we do work with obviously academic institutions to find out more about sleep. It's delivering and creating training. So we train healthcare professionals, teachers, allied health professionals, anyone really, to be fair. And then lastly, kind of our campaigning and sort of comms work. So this is really about lobbying the government around sleep and getting it on that public health agenda.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so many varied roles in just one organisation. There's a lot to do, isn't there?
There is a lot to do, yeah. So we always say we might be small, but we're very mighty, and we will continue to keep banging that drum when it comes to sleep.
It is very important. As a medical student now, getting a lot less sleep than I usually would, I definitely kind of see the effects. I was going to ask, what is your most kind of research campaign that you have done, or just outreach? I'm quite interested.
I would say probably the last really sort of big sort of campaign we did was we launched a sleep manifesto in 2024. It was called Dreaming of Change, and this was quite a big piece of work where we were basically asking the government for to call for a national sleep strategy, really. You know, we wanted to talk about embedding sleep hygiene into public health awareness campaigns. We wanted to get sleep into kind of initiatives that were already out there, like making every contact count. It was about increasing sleep support, because there's a lot of inequalities across the country. So for instance, when it comes to like insomnia, the first line, you know, gold standard treatment is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, but actually access to that it's like postcode lottery. So, you know, there's a lot of people who can't access it. It's not available. So the campaign was really to really highlight sleep. You know, it was to highlight that it's so important, that the impacts of obviously sleep deprivation has on the economy, you know, on productivity in the workplace, but also on kind of like physical and mental health, but also around things like people's relationships. So, you know, we had some really lovely case studies of people who were really happy to share their stories about how lack of sleep really impacted their lives and how they hadn't really had access to sleep support. And the campaign did brilliantly. We got 11 MPs and ministers supporting it at the time of launch. We got like a 12-minute feature on BBC Breakfast. So these are all like amazing things for a small charity, you know, with a, you know, quite a limited budget. And as I said, the campaign was brilliant. Fortunately, what we couldn't predict was, I think it was either 2 or 3 months later, the government held a general election, and a lot of the MPs who were really engaged in our campaign lost their seats. So we've had to kind of restart all those conversations again. But, you know, things are happening. You know, it's really, off the back of that campaign, I really feel like we've managed to get sleep on that agenda. It might not be as high up as I'd like it still, but it is becoming a talking point, and especially the fact that sleep is so interlinked with other health conditions. You know, we know that obviously it's linked closely with like heart disease and Alzheimer's and, you know, type 2 diabetes. So it's really important that, you know, we really, you know, think about sleep quite closely, really, and quite seriously as well.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that we're having this talk right now, because that means we can kind of communicate about your sleep charity more and then raise awareness. Okay, so my next question for you is, what do you know about sleep hygiene? Because it's a very big buzzword right now, but what does it actually mean?
Sometimes, like in the sleep world, we all know what it means, but a lot of people think it might be, well, is that how clean my bed is or something like that? And actually, it's not about anything like that. It's actually a set of guidelines, really, on what we believe from the evidence is what's really good to practice in order to achieve good quality sleep. And there's a little bit of variation out there around maybe what those sort of 10 things might be, but roughly it comes back to things around like consistency in your sleep pattern, in your sleep schedule. So this is about, you know, going to bed and waking up at the same time kind of all the time, because our bodies really thrive on that routine. In particular, getting up at the same time is more important than having a set bedtime, because there are days we generally feel more tired than others, and you don't want to say to everyone you must go to bed at 10 o'clock, but some days it's like 9 o'clock and you can't keep your eyes open. However, by keeping a consistent consistent wake-up time probably means that you'll end up in a really consistent pattern of feeling sleepy at a similar sort of time anyway. And so that's kind of point number one. Two is like, it's looking at like your bedroom environment. You know, a lot of people overlook this when it comes to getting a good night's sleep, but actually where you sleep and what you're sleeping on is really important. You know, that bedroom should be a place where you feel like safe and secure and cozy. And so, you know, ideally you want to be thinking about it being quite cool. Mm-hmm. It's about being dark, because we don't want that light impacting our melatonin levels. It's about having it quiet. Obviously there is an exception where some people do need noise all through the night. It should be like clutter free, because even though you might go to sleep with your eyes closed, then you don't want the last thing you to see before you go to bed is like piles of laundry. And I think as well, lastly, it is looking at that bed. You know, how old is your mattress? How long have you had your pillows? A lot of people hang on to the pillows a lot longer than they should. And it's looking at your bedding as well, making sure it's like fit for purpose. So it's really important, is the bedroom environment. And then there's lots of other kind of lifestyle elements when it comes to sleep hygiene. So it's looking at things like limiting your caffeine if you're sort of sensitive to it. So most people would sort of say from sort of 2 o'clock in the afternoon, switch to decaf or a herbal alternative. Trying to exercise, you know, 20 to 30 minutes every day. It's really good for sleep, but obviously it keeps us healthy as well. And it's really good for kind of stress and anxiety. Limiting the alcohol before bed. So I always say to people, you know, at the sleep charity, we're not the alcohol police. You know, we know people do like to enjoy a glass of wine or whatever, but it's when people start using alcohol as the only way they can fall asleep, that's when it's not good. You know, alcohol shouldn't be used as a sleep aid. So when people say to us, I need at least half a bottle of wine to be able to get up to sleep, we're like, oh no, this is what we need to change. So it's okay to have a glass or two with your evening meal, but as long as it's not the reason you're doing it, you know, it's to fall asleep. And then there's other things about worries and stress and things like that. So it's like, it is a like a comprehensive list of things to look at around basically sleep and lifestyle habits. And it's about making those improvements to sort of enjoy better quality sleep, really.
I feel like all of those that you have listed also definitely affect our mental well-being. Well, since I moved here into this student accommodation, because I'm a first year, it's obviously like a different room, a different environment, but the one thing that has changed is that my curtains are blackout curtains. When I try to wake up in the mornings, I can't wake up as easily as I would in my own room. I have changed the way I do things, so now I've left it half open when I go to sleep, just so the sunlight is there in the morning, and I'm a little confused because I thought that like, if the room is completely dark, I would sleep better and wake up on time, but it's having the reverse effect. Do you know why?
I think it's more that obviously having a dark room when it comes to bedtime is really important, because what we need obviously is that darkness obviously increases the melatonin levels. Like I said, melatonin is obviously the sleep hormone, and obviously we need more of that hormone to make us feel sleepy. However, especially obviously as we head into this time of year when the clocks have changed, the mornings are really dark, and most people say they find it really hard to get out of bed because there's not that same natural light coming in. So it's we need the darkness at night time, but then we need light in the morning. Quite a lot of people who really, really struggle in winter sort of getting up find it quite useful to use things like sunshine alarm clocks or light boxes or some sort of light therapy, which, like, I don't know if you've heard of the sunshine alarm clocks, but they gradually get brighter. So your alarm kind of, so it kind of keeps getting, so obviously there's nothing worse than waking up and someone putting a bright light on because you're like this, I can't see. So it's one that sort of gradually gets brighter and brighter, so obviously you wake
you're
up with
used
it.
To it.
And a lot of people do find those quite useful at this time of year. Obviously, we don't have that same sort of effect in summer because obviously it's quite light. So therefore, we often need those blackout curtains to actually sort of block out that morning sunlight at like 4:30 or something like that when nobody wants to be getting up.
I actually have a research module right now all about sleep, and I'm actually taking part in a study, and it is all about sleep apps. Has your charity kind of dabbled in using sleep apps, or like, have they been shown to be effective?
That's a really good question as well. So we don't personally obviously use them, but we obviously you know, are very well aware of the fact that there are a number of sleep apps out there. You can track your sleep through your Apple Watches, your Fitbits, and all sorts of other sort of gizmos and gadgets these days. And we kind of have a sort of a mixed view on it in terms of, in some ways they've been great in terms of, I think they've helped create a lot of public awareness around sleep over the last few years. A bit like how when they first came out, people got really interested in, should I be walking, you know, I should be walking 10,000 steps a day and things like that. You know, it really gets people thinking about their sleep and actually maybe taking it more seriously. However, kind of on the flip side of that, what we've seen as well is people becoming really obsessed with the data yes. around it. And what we do know, obviously, is that, I mean, it's got a lot better, but the data isn't wholly accurate. Mm. You know, you'd never really get such accurate data unless you obviously, you know, had actigraphy watches or you'd had your sleep done in a lab or something like that. And so it has created a cohort of people who, there is a term, I think it's called orthosomnia.
Yes, that's right. I remember.
Where people have obviously become really obsessed with their sleep off the back of it, but it's actually now giving them sort of insomnia because yeah. they're actually now overthinking sleep.
Yeah.
And actually, potentially they were sleeping perfectly well before, mm. but because they've looked at the data and maybe they don't really understand sleep data, mm. have been like, well, it's telling me I'm waking up 14 times a night, I've not had enough deep sleep. And actually, they're actually sleeping pretty well, you know, but they've started to then overthink sleep, so then it becomes that vicious cycle of that stress yeah. and anxiety yeah. in the lead up to bedtime, which we know is obviously a massive contributor to poor sleep.
Are there any other like topics that you would like to talk about that you think are like very relevant?
I mean, we could talk about screens because that's obviously been quite yeah. a thing, hasn't it?
Well, as a young adult, I think like screens are a very big issue in terms of sleep, especially using your phone like right before sleeping. I'm definitely a victim of that as well.
And I think that's the difficulty, is that technology, you know, has burst onto the scene and has developed so much over the last sort of 10 years, you know, especially over the last 10 years. And, you know, I think we've got to accept that there's no getting away from the fact that we are all permanently attached to a yeah. screen at nearly 90% of the time. And there's kind of trying to make people like almost like banish them and things like that, it's never going to happen, especially with younger people as well. It is their connection yeah. to their friends, and you know, there's this massive like FOMO and things like that if they're not involved.
Mm-hmm.
I think kind of our advice, you know, from a charity, is screens aren't all that bad. They are bad, if you know what I mean, but they're not mm-hmm. as bad as we first thought. So yeah. you know, a good few years ago, you know, there was a lot of talk about the blue light from these devices and how mm. you know, it was really going to impact on how long it took you to fall asleep and things like that. But I think what we're finding now is it is more about what people are doing on their phones before bedtime. So it's the constant, you know, very quick scrolling maybe through yeah. TikTok, which is very engaging and very stimulating of the brain. Or it could be, you know, with some, say, adults, for instance, reading like news before bed. Well, actually, we know that a lot of news is very doom and gloom. So actually, is that the right thing we should be consuming before bedtime? We found very, very much in the COVID pandemic that a lot of people started suffering with their sleep because there was obviously a lot of like worry and concern that was having a real impact on people's ability to sleep, because before bed they were reading about, you know, obviously like the latest deaths or all that sort of thing. And obviously it was a massive public health concern, wasn't it? And you know, lots of people really suffered with their sleep off the back of it. I think now it's very much about what it's more like when you get into the bedroom, when you get into bed, that's when you really should stop using your phone, because that's when I think, and I'm guilty of it, you know, I've done it myself, you've put your pyjamas on, you've brushed your teeth, you're feeling sleepy, you get into bed, you pick up your phone one more time, and then 45 minutes later, you're like, exactly. And you've just... You know, technology is evolving as well. I mean, you know, you have to look at like TVs, and back in the day, TVs shut down at whatever it was. I can't remember because I'm not that old, but you know what I mean? But, you know, there was nothing on, say, after 11 o'clock or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And now people can stay up all night binge watching their favourite box set. Do you know what I mean? And we've got like all these, you know, streaming devices now, and we can watch anything at any point and we can binge watch. So we get into this habit of, I started this episode, it was amazing, I'm going to watch the next four. Do you know what I mean? You've watched a season in a whole night, and you've gone to bed way past your bedtime.
And it's really interesting because the way that like social media and streaming services are evolving, they're more convenient for us, but it is also like a double-edged sword because it's too convenient for us.
Absolutely. And it's just modern day life, isn't it? If you think we're going back hundreds of years to see about how light has changed. We've now got so much more artificial light in our homes again that is keeping us awake later. And so, yeah, things do change, but we have to adapt with that as well.
Now, on the final note, are there any interesting projects or initiatives that the charity is working on right now?
So, I mean, we've always got lots of sort of exciting things in the pipeline.
I'm sure, yeah.
We've just recently done a lovely pilot project in South Yorkshire with bedtime bags for children. This is where children, poorer backgrounds, disadvantaged families were getting bedtime bags, which had things like a storybook in, a toothbrush, and trying to kind of help those children who were suffering with, like, I guess what we call like sleep poverty, trying to get them to sleep better, which was a really sort of really nice thing to be involved in.
Oh, that's amazing. And I was just thinking, it's so good that you are able to teach these kind of habits from an early age so that, you know, we grow into adults and then these habits stay. I just think it's a great idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you've made a really good point there in the fact that if we can educate people from an early age, they're likely to carry those really good sleep and lifestyle habits through into being an adult. On the sort of school curriculum, you know, there's a lot around diet and exercise, but not a lot around sleep and how important it is. And yet we know sleep and mental health is so closely linked. And obviously mental health has become a really huge sort of issue again over the past few years. And I think sometimes we don't know what came first. Was it a sleep problem that led to a mental health issue, or did the mental health issue cause a sleep problem? And those things again should be tackled together, really. So sleep definitely needs to be made a priority.
Thank you so much. It was lovely to speak to you, and I look forward to kind of exploring all of these initiatives that you were talking about and see how they progress.
Thank you very much for having me. Science and beyond. Radio Kerwell.
Okay, hello. So who am I speaking with?
Hello, I'm Dr. Nicola Barclay. I'm a senior postdoctoral sleep scientist at the University of Oxford.
Nice to meet you. And for those of you who don't know me, I'm Alex. I'm a first year medical student at the University of Leeds. So what will we be talking about today?
Well, I'm hoping that we're going to talk about sleep and mental health and the intricate links between insomnia, anxiety and depression, and hopefully a bit about how improving sleep may also have knock-on effects on improving mental health.
That sounds really interesting. So let's first start off with getting to know you a little bit. And why did you go into sleep in the first place and research?
I've been in the world of sleep research probably for nearly 20 years now. And initially, I was actually really interested in anxiety and catastrophic worry. And it plagues a lot of us in having these kind of thought spirals that really lead to us catastrophizing and ultimately thinking the worst is going to happen. And at that point, early on, when I was doing my master's, I was really interested in how that impacts on sleep and how catastrophic thoughts at night really make it difficult to get to sleep. I then got a supervisor who was amazing at Goldsmiths at University of London, Professor Alice Gregory, who was also really interested in the links between anxiety and insomnia. And I was fortunate enough to do my PhD with her, looking at genetic and environmental underpinnings of sleep and mental health.
Wow. So I have a question for you. What is like a fun fact that you learned during your PhD? I always love to ask this question, but is there anything interesting or really cool that you learned?
A fun fact, probably people that know anything about sleep or have read any books on sleep will have heard of unilateral sleep, which is apparent in several different species, particularly dolphins and some long migrating birds. And what it is that half of their brain sleeps at a time while the other half of the brain is wide awake.
Wow.
And so it's so that they can maintain swimming in the ocean or flying through the sky for many, many days or months on end, and the brain can sleep half a brain at a time. I think that's really cool.
That is so cool. I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Fun fact.
Yeah, one of the best ones so far, I think. Okay, thank you so much. So moving on to the present, what are you doing now and how did you get involved in this study?
So now I'm working at the University of Oxford. I've been here for around nearly 9 years, actually. I was in a teaching role at Oxford, teaching sleep medicine to health professionals, but now I've moved primarily into research and research on how behavioural sleep interventions can improve insomnia and mental health. And the focus of our research is largely around how we can use components of cognitive behavioural therapy and how we can impact on sleep with behavioural sleep interventions and how that can help anxiety and depression, and if it does, what the mechanism is behind it. And I've been working in this project since around July 2024, so about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been developing a program of research to really understand the mechanisms of how behavioral sleep interventions work. to give us kind of that scientific understanding as to what is the biology around it. Mm-hmm. And we started developing the first of three randomized controlled trials, and we are underway with the first one and we're currently open to recruitment.
That's amazing. So what is the purpose of this trial specifically?
So this trial is really looking to see whether a behavioural sleep program which tailors sleep timing, I'm not allowed to tell you what it is because we need some degree of mystery and we don't want to influence the study by people knowing too much about it. So we have two treatment groups. We have one sleep improvement program which tailors sleep timing, and another sleep improvement program which provides detailed education about multiple factors associated with good sleep. And what we're trying to do here is to identify how sleep changes over the course of treatment, and also what changes we see in mental health outcomes. So for this study, we do really in-depth assessment of people's sleep, but also an in-depth assessment of their biological clock, because we really want to see, are there elements of sleep that change, and are there elements of the biological clock that changes? So because we're manipulating sleep timing, we want to see, well, actually, does the timing of our biology change? So what we do, we have our lovely team of researchers cycle out to people's houses and perform a sleep study. And what that involves is a whole bunch of electrodes across the head and in some senses on the body to give us a good picture of what their objective sleep looks like. And this measures the electrical activity in the brain and the body over the course of a night. And that gives us a good baseline of what their usual sleep looks like. And in these patients, we're usually seeing people with insomnia, anxiety, and depression. We then also have them come to a lab where we take hourly saliva samples from them. And this gives us a really good understanding of the timing of their clock. So when we sample saliva, we can sample something called melatonin. And melatonin is sometimes called the hormone of darkness. It's secreted around 3 hours before we typically fall asleep, and it readies the brain for sleep. It's not a hypnotic, it doesn't send us to sleep, but it sets off a cascade of physiological events that make us sleepy and make us fall asleep. So we want to get a measure of when this onsets in people. We can get a good timing of that. So participants come to the lab in the dark, and we do hourly saliva samples until around about 2 a.m. and then they can go home and get in a taxi home. We also have a load of questionnaires, and at that point they then get randomized to treatment groups. And the treatment group is treatments delivered by our really lovely trained therapists, and these are largely occur online. We have one in-person session which lasts about an hour, which is quite intense. Gives a lot of information about the study, about the treatments, about how they're going to receive the treatment. And then each follow-up session is 15 minutes online, so it's really easy for people to fit into their day. But also it means that they are actively involved in something which is going to improve their sleep. We've run studies in our lab, but also other labs across the world. It's not only our group, but multiple groups across the world have shown that these particular sleep improvement programs do improve insomnia. And we know that insomnia affects around 30% of the adult population. And so if we said to people, right, taking part in our program can fix your sleep and hopefully help fix mental health difficulties as well, I think we would get a lot of people really interested in making small changes to their sleep patterns, and with that having an impact on their life.
That sounds amazing. And you definitely answered one of my questions, which was about the saliva sample and the biological clock. I was going to ask you why that happens, but you already answered it for me. That is so interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
And a question for you as well. I was just wondering what the criteria is needed for a patient to be able to participate in this study.
Yeah, really good question. So we're looking for people who are between the ages of 18 and 30. We're looking for young adults, as this is the age group where we quite often see mental health difficulties emerge. And so we're really wanting to see whether if we can target sleep in this early age of adult life, whether we can prevent further problems in later life. So people who are between the ages of 18 to 30 with difficulty sleeping, and we will assess sleep with a screening questionnaire online, plus also then a follow-up call with one of our research team, just to make sure that the study's right for them, that it's capturing the right type of sleep difficulty. They also have to have symptoms of either anxiety or symptoms of depression. And there's quite a few exclusions as well, not being pregnant, not going on holiday, and not having already taken part in this study before. We've got a whole long list, but the main inclusions are insomnia and either anxiety or depression or the combination of both.
That is a very good insight for me, kind of how difficult research might be sometimes and kind of recruiting participants, because there's such a long list of those who can't participate, and I'm only now understanding how difficult it might be, especially because I want to get involved in research myself.
And sleep is a complex one, because if you speak to a lot of people have difficulty sleeping, but it can be for many different reasons. I think off the top of my head now, there are over 50 different sleep disorders documented in the DSM-5, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, which is kind of like the Bible that clinicians go on for identifying and diagnosing different mental health complaints. And so sleep isn't just one thing. Difficulty getting to sleep isn't all the same for everybody. And so we run the screening calls to really understand a bit more about people's sleep in depth, because it can be very different, especially for young people. Young people's sleep is actually quite complex and is developing over the lifespan. And we see characteristic changes during sleep in young adults. And so we really want to make sure that the participants who are enrolled on the study are going to benefit from this particular treatment.
I was also curious, what happens after the study? So when you've finished, are there any follow-ups or...
Yeah, good question. So after the, well, during the treatment, we also have another home sleep study in the middle. And then at the end of treatment, at around 8 weeks, between 8 and 10 weeks, we also go back to the house and do another sleep study, as well as repeating the lab assessment. And then at 6 months follow-up, we also have a bunch of questionnaires. It's pretty intense for around 10 weeks. But then beyond that, at 6 months, it's a couple of online questionnaires.
Now, because I am quite on top of my research knowledge right now, are there any kind of techniques that you're implementing or kind of things that, to avoid bias?
Yeah, really good question. Quite often with behavioural or psychological interventions, it can be very difficult to have a convincing control group. So if you're running a pharmacological study, a randomised controlled trial with two groups, and you've got a pill, you've got an active pill for a condition in one group, and then you have a sugar pill in the other. Yeah. It's very easy in that case for the participant not to know which group they're in. When it comes to delivering psychological interventions or behavioural interventions, it can be pretty clear which group you're in. And that can lead to bias in randomised controlled trial designs. So one way that you can overcome that is to try to have two almost identical treatments or treatment delivery methods, but one of the programmes is of the active treatments and the other program is of an inactive treatment. And so we're trying to overcome that by having both groups receive a behavioural sleep intervention. And that the basis of that is really what people would typically get in routine care. And the way that we deliver that is with intense hour-long session for the first session and then follow-up sessions. And we match that in both groups. So both groups get the exact same amount of therapist time. And we know that in psychological therapies as well, or in psychological interventions, there can be an impact of just speaking to somebody or just having or just taking part in a study. So we're trying to match for that so that everybody, regardless of which group, gets the same amount of therapist interaction.
And if there is, in fact, someone out there listening right now who would really love to get involved and find out if they are eligible, how might they get into contact with you?
Oh, that's a really good question, because we are open to recruitment and we're going to be recruiting to this study for a few months, maybe even maybe 18 months or so. Importantly, it's important to say that people have to be based in Oxford or Oxfordshire, largely because we're out on our bikes, cycling to people's houses, do the home sleep study. There's only so far we can go. Plus, also, it does require the in-lab visit as well. Importantly, we do reimburse people for reasonable travel expenses to get back home after that lab visit. But if people are interested in finding more about the study or participating, then they can email our study at spectrum.study@ndcn.ox.ac.uk. It's a little bit of a mouthful. Maybe we can pop it in the comments of the podcast.
Okay, sounds great. And is there anything else that you would like to add at all? What would that be all?
I need just to say that prioritising sleep is one of the best things that you can do to set up your life, really. Because quite often we want to extend our day, we want to watch another Netflix programme or, you know, go to a party or hang out with our friends. But prioritising our sleep early in our life can really set us up for the best way that we can.
Science and Beyond.